Welcome to Ida History, the show that digs up the most thought-provoking stories from Idaho's history. Here are your hosts, Jeff Wade and Mark Iverson.
That's right. This is Ida History, the podcast. I'm Jeff Wade, one of your hosts, and the other host is looking at me with his beady eyes. Mr.
Like any true sun-deprived historian, Jeff.
Yes, that's true. Mr. Mark Iverson, my co-host. What's happening, Mark?
You know, Jeff, not a whole lot. Just chilling.
Chilling. Hey, so tell us about what you did last night.
Oh, well, yeah. I went on down to the Ada County Courthouse with our friend Melissa Call, Birchleaf Realty.
Hi, Melissa.
Hey, Melissa. My pal, my buddy.
Yeah.
My compatriot.
What the heck was going on at the Ada County Courthouse last night?
Well, so basically last night there was a petition being heard by the Ada County Commissioners. And it's basically this push to, what would they say,
dissolve the Meridian Library District.
Yeah, yeah. So they're looking to dissolve the library district because of a few books, but one thing that was really great was that last night, at least 51 people that testified in front of the commission, per the Boise Dev, said that 51 were against the dissolution of the library, and only 11 testified for getting rid of the library. And the thing is that if they were to get rid of the library district, it wouldn't be, okay, well, new people will take over. They would get rid of it. They would destroy things.
They would have to basically find new buildings, yep. Buy new books,
yep.
Computers, equipment.
Everything.
Hire new people.
Yeah, and the books in question, you know, have not legally been defined as obscene. So therefore, they cannot be put behind a desk or censored in any way legally. You know, and it's very evident from what I heard last night that parents have to approve of, you know, basically if their kids get a library card, they can sign up and be notified basically every time their kid checks something out. So if they don't like what their kids checked out, they can return the book immediately.
So if our listeners want to learn a little bit more about what's going on with this situation, check out our friends Natalie and Shane over at the Boise Bubble podcast. They recently did an episode and they interviewed the director of the Meridian Library.
Library, I believe, yeah.
So that's a great episode. Kind of fills in. I just wanted to bring it up because, Mark, you and I are kind of on different areas of the political spectrum. As far as, I mean, we're closer sometimes than we think, but
I don't really know where I am all the time.
Right.
But I do know,
especially lately, it's gotten really confusing.
Yeah. But I do know that most people out there, there's a canary in the coal mine sort of thing. And when you're trying to get rid of books because you don't agree with them in a public place, I think a lot of people's radar went on high alert. And and I'm definitely for the structures of democracy, republic, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. Most people aren't for getting rid of books because you don't agree with them.
Yeah, no, like we definitely, like you're neo-Marxist. I voted for Trump.
Yeah. Well, obviously. So,
yeah. But we can both agree, Mark, that getting rid of libraries and burning books are bad things for a democracy or a constitutional republic, which is we live
for
under.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I just want to put that out there. Yeah. Other than that, Mark, are you ready for this episode that we're talking about tonight?
I sure am. You know, tonight we're talking about a few complex issues that tie into Idaho history.
Yeah, speaking of, right?
Yeah, right. And it's first and foremost, we're talking about tuberculosis, which a lot of people don't realize was like the deadliest disease in history.
Yeah.
Not even close. Killed more people than AIDS.
Hitler.
Yeah, Hitler,
Mussolini.
Mussolini, Stalin. But it's from ancient times till now, it's the ultimate killer. The white plague, consumption, tuberculosis.
Did you happen to listen to that Sawbones podcast I sent you?
I did. It was interesting. They got a few things off, but, you know, they didn't claim to be experts, so.
Well, the lady is a doctor. but I don't know what kind of doctor she is. Obviously, she's not. I don't know if she's an infectious disease doctor, but.
Well, they were kind of laughing at something that we'll talk about later about air in a cave and, you know, cold air and things bad like air. That. But it actually did, you know, kind of subdue the illness and allow some people to prolong their lives.
One of the things that stuck out to me is that they say up to 1/3 of our population currently has been exposed or infected with tuberculosis.
I have.
It's great.
Yeah. When I was in the Peace Corps in Bulgaria back in 2008, I and another person who worked at a, well, basically juvenile detention center, but it was pretty much a prison for Roma kids. The insulting way to say it is gypsy. But these kids had to, one of these kids had to have had, you know, active TB to give me TB. But what I did have is latent TB, you know, so I got the skin test and it was red and I had to take, the bump was red 2 days later and I had to take these big horse pills for like 9 months.
Did you ever have to have a chest x-ray?
I did. Okay. Yeah. And that was fine. But, you know, it can lay latent in people or dormant for decades.
So we're going to talk about on this episode someone who kind of pioneered the use of chest x-rays for tuberculosis treatment, right?
Yeah. So Dr. Alan Hart has quite the story and a very unique doctor. And we'll get into his story here soon, you know, but we'll get into the history of tuberculosis just as a little foundation and then get into TB in Idaho and we'll talk about how Dr. Alan Hart changed things for thousands of Idahoans.
Sounds good. Mark, you have a couple sources to mention here at the top?
I do. You know, we won't go through them all. You can find them on our podcast site on the website, idahistory.com, where you can also listen to our most current episodes. But one book that was really interesting, and I'm still reading, but I really wanted a foundation, was about the famous Waverly Hills Sanatorium in Kentucky.
Ooh, I've heard that's very haunted.
It's super haunted, but the history is haunting, if you will, Jeff. Ooh. But it's very interesting. But the book is by C.C. Thomas, and it is called With Their Dying Breath, A History of Waverly Hills Tuberculosis Sanatorium. Came out in 2007. Another important primary source was by Dr. J. Allen Gilbert, and it was called Homosexuality and Its Treatment. And this was a study of Dr. Alan Hart done in 1920 at the University of Oregon Medical School. Hmm. And then one I really relied on was Colin Close's Manifesting Manhood, Dr. Alan Hart's Transformation and the Embodiment of Sex in the Early 20th Century Sexology. It wasn't a quick read, but it was chock full of good information. You know, and I have lots of other articles I could mention, you know, that had to do with, for instance, the highest rate of death and numbers of the afflicted in the United States for TB were Native Americans.
Of course, yeah. That's something, yeah, I'd like to cover that at length.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hell of a topic. But the reason I'm talking about homosexuality and transness is because Dr. Alan Hart, whether he would have recognized this about himself or not, was the first female to male transition surgery in the United States. And by this happened in 1918, but by the time 1933 rolls around and Dr. Alan Hart really starts working with Idahoans and then later in Idaho, he is just strictly going by Alan Hart. And so it's quite the interesting tale. And then, you know, we have various primary documents, but they're from the Dr. Alan Hart collection at Lewis and Clark College, the one in Portland. So from their archival collections, you know, various newspaper articles from newspapers.com from inside Idaho and elsewhere, CDC statistics, and information about the Gooding TB Hospital, that Dr. Hart had a part in starting. And this was found in the Idaho Anti-Tuberculosis Association collection at the State Archives.
There's so a mouthful.
Yeah, right. We sure would like to thank them. But yeah, tons of articles and scholarly publications. We'll put these out on the webpage.
Yeah. All right. Well, shall we get into the story, Mark?
I think we should, Jeff.
All right.
Well, so prior to researching this episode, what would you say was the leading cause of death throughout history? I know we just talked about TB, but what would have a few of them been?
What would I think? I would think being crushed by a farm animal was probably up there somewhere.
You know, that is kind of prevalent, isn't it?
Right. What else? Obviously, violence is going to be a big one. War.
Yeah.
Murder. Mayhem. Murder, mayhem, and Boise. So I just sneak that in there.
Oh, yeah. Great book, yeah, by the way.
Fire book. Yeah. Other than that, like, obviously, disease and, you know.
The Black Plague.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good one. It doesn't even hold a feather to the White Plague, tuberculosis. You know, some might say cholera or typhoid, typhus. Nope. Tuberculosis.
TB.
You know, it goes way back. So we know now that it is indeed the number one champ of all time is tuberculosis. But this is a bacteria, and the bacterium tuberculosis, as it's called, and that is how Robert Koch, a German bacteriologist and physician, called it. But man, it's some nasty shit.
Yeah, it really is. It can spread to your spine, your brain, all around your guts, your glands, and your outer skin. And it all starts from the lungs, right?
Oh, yeah. It's super gross. And, you know, it's like these little hot dog-looking microbes under the microscope. But once these things get in you, it can spread through the blood to your glands. And when your glands, it gets in your glands, especially around your neck, you get like TB neck, and so your glands swell up and they'll leak pus when wounds start. And they create open wounds. So when you have open wounds all over your face and on your legs and stuff, wherever, it's called scrofula. And like the Greeks thought it was separate disease. They didn't know it was the same thing. But now we know it's a different stage of tuberculosis.
Mm. Mm. Hope no one's eating while they're listening to this.
Think a deep, dark red fried chicken batter.
Just kidding. So as TB, or consumption as it was called, because it basically consumes your body, you know, consumes you physically, has been around for thousands of years, recorded as early as ancient Egypt. So Mark, this is one of the oldest recorded diseases known to man, right?
Yeah, you know, it really is. It's ancient.
So, of course, once, you know, population grows, people start crowding into cities, tuberculosis is going to become even worse.
See, the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century accelerated TB spread. So, as workforces lived clustered around factories, slaughterhouses, warehouses, stockyards, you know, most often in heavily populated and densely packed urban areas. Well, it wasn't until the 1880s that anyone understood consumption wasn't hereditary, you know, but it was instead spread through mucus and saliva in sneezes, coughs, or through spitting.
Bless you.
Yes, sir. Achoo.
It was Robert Koch, a German physician, who proved that it was not poor genetics that made one catch TB, but it was especially the snot and the mucus, which sprayed shotgun style from someone's mouth. Which, Mark, I'm just thinking about all those, you know, graphics on CNN and the news that we've seen over the last 3 years about,
right,
you know, the spread of, you know, obviously COVID-19 has a lot of similarities with this disease, right?
I mean, if we could all see what we put forth out into a packed room, you know, with just a little achoo,
yeah,
we would all be wearing hazmat suits, man.
Yeah, definitely. But here in like drier climates, like here in like southern Idaho, Mark, when the bacterium TB, it dries out and then it lays dormant, and then you can breathe it in with dust.
Yeah, right. Now that's another thing. Like this is, it doesn't just die when it goes into like the fresh air and sunlight. It lays dormant and wait, like, you know, the aliens, James Cameron so beautifully constructed in the 1980s. But it's funny because between Roman times and the 19th century, many treatments were tried and many failed. But what doctors and scientists returned to were the treatment methods of the Romans. The ancients said that isolation and fresh air plus plenty of healthy eating might manage the illness. And so, after physicians looked at many histories of ancient medicine, sanatoriums came into fashion, especially after, you know, 1890, because word had gotten out that TB was in fact infectious and that victims of the nasty little critters ought to be isolated from the uninfected majority.
So you had these things called sanatoriums that popped up, and they filled multiple roles. They kept consumptives, or lungers, as they were also called. Who was the famous lunger I'm thinking of? Wyatt Earp. He was a lunger.
Oh, right? Doc Holliday, man.
Or Doc Holliday, yeah.
Yeah.
So they called him a lunger. Kind of a weird nickname, but it makes sense because it affects your lungs, right?
It sure does.
So these sanatoriums kept the infected away from the uninfected, but they also became centers of rest for the afflicted. These medical facilities were often high up in the mountains or in forested areas or perhaps in a cool and distant high desert location. But the cold and clean air did help slow the progression of disease in many cases. And, you know, they would often prescribe constant rest and a healthy diet, which also helped.
Yeah, but TB could also seem to improve. That's the tricky thing. But it would actually just go dormant for a long time and come back with vengeance. You know, so dying of TB affected the young, the old, the healthy and robust adults, everybody. And as a person's lungs deteriorated, consumptives began to cough up blood and lung tissue with the blood eventually. So if the bacteria moved to the brain, patients would seem senile or enter states of delirium. If it entered the bones, the pain was agonizing, and most horribly for many, it disfigured people by eating away at people's faces and bodies if it became scrofula, basically wounds spreading from the glands, as we said, on the outside of a sufferer's body.
Ugh. Kind of squeamish here, Mark.
Yeah, it's kind of grody.
So, you know, it's kind of weird that a lot of people, like, kind of idealized what the TB look was, like the kind of sunken in cheeks, the pale flesh.
Like Twilight.
Yeah. I don't think they shimmer in the sun or whatever? What was that?
Yeah, crap. That didn't happen with TB.
Right. Or real vampires.
Yeah.
So there are many people out there who think of kind of like the idealized type of TB patient, you know, the stricken artist, the genius of the Romantic age, like, you know, poet John Keats, who died in Rome as a consumptive in 1821, or the famous Lord Byron, you know, the Charge of the Light Brigade, who in fact told the world he wanted to die by consumption. And this is what Lord Byron said. Listen to this. Listen, Mark. He said, "How pale I look, I should like, I think, to die of consumption, because then the women would say, 'See that poor Byron, how interesting he looks in dying.'"
Well, sadly, the good Lord Byron did not get his wish.
Poor guy,
yeah, I know. He ultimately died of malaria, most believe, on April 24th, 1824, in Messaloniki, Greece, fighting for Greek independence alongside the Greeks against the Ottoman Turks. He's still a hero there.
No.
But he looked gaunt and pale. And he was a brilliant man, as was Keats. So the fashionable wanted to look like vampires in their high neck dresses, shirts, and coats. You know, they carried dainty handkerchiefs into which they coughed, and they sought to die as gracefully as possible. You know, even if the upper classes didn't have TB, they still tried to dress like they did in Victorian England, you know,
that's
and elsewhere.
So messed up.
Yeah, I know, right?
So for the poor and downtrodden, this was hardly the case. They were living packed together in the slums of Paris, and, you know, they were the poor working people of London. You know, these people, they would die in mass, often to be thrown into a pauper's grave, or even worse, a mass disease pit. You know, think of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Bring out your dead.
Yeah, although that was the plague, but, you know, you get the point. That's yes, what it was like, right? Oh, yeah. But, you know, getting to American chores, Jeffrey. when people started coming over to Well America, hop the pond, you know, it had been in America before in native communities. So prior to European contact, but more and more of this TB flooded into the Americas with the immigrants as they arrived. And it spread quicker as people began to live in denser and denser urban settings in America. And so, you know, these places mostly, you know, where, you know, there was more poverty, they always had inadequate or no sanitation services or mechanisms at all. And more than 50% of the population in America during the 19th or early 20th century died of tuberculosis. That's people who had disease.
Did you say 50% of the population in America died of TB?
No, of who had disease died of tuberculosis.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. But Jeff, remember, we made that bet about the number one killer in the 19th century.
I still think it was farm animal accidents.
You said cholera, Jeff. You lost, so cough it up, bud.
I don't remember saying cholera, but okay. I'll get you a beer.
Cough it up. there you go. Sorry, that's a bad joke. I think you might want to get rid of that one.
No, I'm going to leave that one in.
Okay.
Yeah, that's terrible. Of course, this all moved westward as America expanded into the frontier territories. Territories. So yeah, it moved west with westward expansion, I guess would be another way to say that.
Okay.
So the first sanatorium, it's not like the Metallica song, right?
Well, so yeah, actually sanitarium. So in the Waverly Hills book, I didn't write this or anything, you know, but in the book, she says a sanatorium is like more like a hospital, a care facility, whereas a sanitarium has more rest and relaxation. Think a spa. So really, Metallica's song is about a spa.
I thought it was about a mental facility, but
yeah, I think they got that wrong. But maybe this lady in the book got it wrong. I don't know.
Well, I think that was a common usage because I've heard of that other places. But yeah, the first sanatorium in the United States was built in a cave, which was the Mammoth Cave Complex in Kentucky in May of 1842, when the owner of this land and the cave, I kind of want to buy a cave, but
I would love to have a cave.
Right? Yeah. So Dr. John Croghan, who also had TB, he moved 10 of these consumptives into this cave, which is far less than he had hoped for, but you know. 10, you know, you gotta start somewhere.
Well, yeah, you know, and it was to be an experiment. So he eventually wanted to stuff that cave with about 120 individuals, but that was not possible after it was really difficult for 10 people to live in there. But it still isn't as crazy as it sounds. You know, the cave had previously been a mine for saltpeter, which had been mined by enslaved people prior to Croghan owning the property. They possessed far above average health for an enslaved person at the time and place, and they especially lacked any ailments of the lungs. Caves were known for possessing healthy, pure waters and clean air. Yet, and this wasn't evident at the time, as the people didn't know what passed on TB, Croghan didn't consider what would happen once humans began to live and be treated far inside the cave.
So what happens is you have 10 people and they're feeding them beans and they start farting.
That's right.
And then there's this methane. Bunch of methane buildup and it explodes. Yeah, it's terrible. No, that's not what happened. They built stone structures and wood-sided canvas tents from inside the mouth of the cave, and that's where the doctor's quarters were, to as far as a mile down inside of this cave. But these houses were heated with wood and coal stoves, and they started building up smoke from all of these fires and such. So, you know, probably not a good idea for people who are already suffering from ailments of the lung.
Yeah, right. You know, I just found this out, though, and the cave was still offering tours. It was offering tours all the way back in the 1840s. And while this was a sanitarium, people would walk by and look into these people's domiciles.
Oh, so it's like a zoo.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And these people are like, what the fuck are you looking at? I'm dying of TB. Get out of here. You know? Wow. But another one of the major problems, though, was the humidity in the cave. You know, it was constantly damp. Mm. Clothes needed cleaning constantly due to the amount of sweat patients saturated their clothing with. And this meant that more fires had to be burned at all times to boil the water, meaning more smoke. Mold was also a problem for, you know, the lungers, and it became a real big problem. So, you know, you don't want to breathe that in. You don't want to breathe the smoke in. You don't want to always be wet when you have, you know. And then there was no sunlight. We all need some vitamin D. And so these patients were in the dark all the time. So basically, a doctor who wanted to come see how the experiment was going wrote of the patients that those patients who remained in the cave presented a frightening appearance. The face was entirely bloodless, eyes sunken and pupils dilated to such a degree that the iris ceased to be visible. It soon appeared black.
Wow.
Yeah.
So all 10 patients died within a few years of the cave experience, because of course they did, because but some of them are buried in the cave and are buried up top by the cave. How big was this cave? Had it been pretty sizable.
It's mammoth cave. It's like one of the biggest there are in the nation, I think. I'm no spelunker, Jeff, but I do like to descend into a cave every now and then. One of my favorite movies is The Descent. Ever seen that one?
I saw that in the theater.
Yeah.
It was a scary movie.
Turned me on. Oh, wait. No, never mind. I'm not supposed to say that.
Right.
Spelunking.
Turned you on to spelunking.
Spelunking. Okay. But I digress. Sorry. But anyway, so painful surgeries were attempted sometimes moving on from the cave. This is other treatments. People were really desperate for a cure. So, yeah, these surgeries were attempted and sometimes, but rarely, worked. Portions of infected lungs were cut away. But it was a challenge to get all the bacteria out and to not kill the patient in the process. So these surgeries were a trial and error, to say the least. But people were desperate. An infected lung could be collapsed, you know, as well. But this would mean a large incision was cut into, like, the back and the side. Ribs were cut away, kind of opened, and then the lung was punctured. And sometimes later on, ping pong balls were added to the chest cavity where the lung had once been to keep the lung collapsed. And the other methods involved punching a hole through the chest and into the lung to collapse it that way.
I really wish our listeners could see the face I'm making right now.
Yeah, right? It doesn't. The cutting away of the ribs sounds particularly, yeah. You know.
Yeah. The idea that was an inactive lung could be better treated. So they basically broke the lung and then thought they could make it better.
Yeah, really. They thought that the TB would perhaps die, go away, it would become inactive.
Yeah, so yeah, these were desperate procedures from doctors desperate to cure their patients and patients desperate not to die. So basically they were experimenting on them. That's great.
Yeah, but all the greatest medical procedures were... You know, somebody was into extreme surgeries at one point or really needed one.
That's true. After 1882, patients became even more desperate for a cure as their contracting TB was seen as similar to catching other infectious diseases. Victims faced societal ostracization and... Did I say that right?
Ostracization? Ostracization? I think you had it right, man. Okay.
Victims faced societal ostracization and were made to put their lives on halt and isolate themselves in private and state-run sanatoriums. And if they couldn't do that, they remained trapped in their homes, isolated in rooms, even away from their own families. Again, this sounds a lot like something that we all went through just recently.
Exactly, except way too much contact with our families, I think.
That's true.
I love the little buggers. That was a lot. Yeah. Yes. Now, but basically, Idaho was a largely rural setting, right? Still is kind of rural.
Yeah.
But
hopefully it stays that way.
Yeah. We'll see.
Okay.
So I guess it was less impacted by TB than, you know, New York in the slums, but it still had its fair share. You got to think per population, too. And so in Boise City, 1905 and 1906, a Boise doctor named E.E. Maxey shared some statistics with the Idaho Daily Statesman. And he informed the public that in 1906, 31 Boise residents had died of TB. And that this increased from the year before, from 21. And so in 1905. But, you know, in 1906, they had a total of 247 or 74. Shoot, I forget. I don't have my notes. But either way, 31 out of that 277 was a sizable chunk, considering that, you know, the number one after that is like pneumonia and then typhoid and, you know, different fevers. Mm-hmm. Always disease. And then you actually did have accidents, farm accidents and things like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, see?
What's yeah, we've there? Talked about a few of them on the show.
It's true. As long as you're not cleaning your stove with gasoline.
Oh, gosh.
Still don't understand that one.
Yeah, right. Check out our book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Murder, Mayhem, and Boise.
Yeah, yeah.
So in comparison to other diseases, TB was the number one killer in Boise, in total with 52 deaths between 1905 and 1906. And many cases went unreported. Because you don't want to be shipped off to a sanatorium.
Right.
Pneumonia came in second in 1906 with 24 deaths reported, but first in 1905 with 22 deaths reported for a total of 46 deaths. Typhoid killed 17 and 19, respectively, coming in third.
But Idahoans were scared to report themselves, as we said, for fear of being ostracized or sent to a pest house, as they were called, or a sanatorium. At Fort Boise, they had a TB ward with a room in the 1910 hospital labeled Dead Room. So no wonder people didn't want to go there. You know, I watched a few different documentaries and they're saying, geez, when you went to one of these places, you're pretty sure you were going to go die in a foreign place far away from home.
So, Mark, here's a real experience that I've had working in prison among inmates where... You know that they're sick and you hear coughing all up and down a tier,
mm-hmm.
but they're not reporting it and they're not going to medical to get tested because they don't want to go to isolation. So, yeah, it happens.
I mean, can you blame them? You go to a sterile white room in a sanatorium, probably in prison too.
No, you're just in another cell away from other people.
But, well, yeah, it would just not be the best place to be afraid to die, right?
Right.
You know, it's just harsh. But, you know, so there was also... a place behind Fort Boise at the east end of Pueblo Street called the Pest House. People would go there. They were people with money most of the time, so from your middle, upper middle class or richer. But they would go to this house. They would die there, not just of TB, but primarily TB. And when they were done, if they survived, they would go into a kind of tent structure behind up in the foothills, get like sanitized, have to wait for a certain period, and then they could re-enter town. Mm. But for your TB people, it was the long haul, you know, and, you know, there were various pest houses throughout the city and, you know, the state for sure throughout up until the 1950s, you know, and then it kind of ebbed down.
On the Nez Perce Reservation, according to tribal member Madonna Swan, and she says, quote, the white sanitarium was where people went to be cured of tuberculosis. The Indian sanitarium was where people went to die. There wasn't a family on the reservation that was not impacted by TB. You know, everyone lost someone.
So one of the sanatoriums for TB was at Fort Lapwai. I mean, it had... open-air porches for beds for the cold treatment. And this is where fresh cold air was thought to revive the lungs and slow the onslaught of TB. And Fort Lapwai was the Nez Perce mission, and wasn't it, basically?
I've always heard it pronounced Lapwai.
Lapwai?
Yeah.
Okay. But so the people died there, as the death certificate of 13-year-old Ellery Cloud shows. He died at the sanatorium on August 2nd, 1933, of tuberculosis meningitis, which had spread from his initial illness of pulmonary TB.
So is that it spread from his lungs to his spine?
Yeah. And Amos McDonald also died of TB there on March 13th, 1922, at the age of 48. Many other graves of TB victims lie in the Lapway Mission Cemetery, and many of those people died from complications kind of wrought by TB.
So TB thrives among people in poverty, unfortunately. You know, not like they don't have enough to make their life crappy.
Exactly.
And there's less resources directed at them because of that. The World Health Organization states that in 1913, a whole 12.1% of white Americans that contracted TB died from the disease, while the number of Native Americans sat at 35.4%. This disparity holds true of Idaho as well. However, we will need to do, like we talked about, Mark, an entire episode, if not, you know, a couple of them, to discuss sanatoriums for Native Americans in Idaho and also Indian schools, because they're very connected. But just to give you an idea, the superintendent of the North Idaho Indian Agency, Oscar Lips, great name.
Yeah, I know, right?
Stated that in 1910, that 75% of the Nez Perce had tuberculosis in some form.
Yes, that's a startling number. And the point is, for the poor, and mostly especially Native Americans, though not all Native Americans are poor, of course, more people die from infectious diseases that experience poverty, and it is still a sad fact today.
And so things don't always improve with time. In 1937, Idaho papers noted a stark increase in the number of TB cases reported, and this aligned with a cut in spending by the legislature for state-run TB hospitals. The papers noted that 139 Idahoans were afflicted with TB in 1937, as opposed to just 40 the year before. So it went up almost 100 cases in a year. While these numbers don't seem extreme, it must be noted that not everyone, like we said before, will report that numbers had dwindled significantly due to the effective screening, treatment, and education campaigns in the 1930s. Now, this was largely the work of one man and a physician, a specialist in radiology, TB researcher. Also, he was a novelist. Mark, before we talk about the hero of this story, why don't we take a quick ad break and we'll come right back.
Sounds good, Jeff.
All right. Hey, Mark, we should meet downtown for a cup of coffee.
We should, Jeff.
Where do you want to meet?
I'd like to go where we always go, Flying M Coffee House, down in Boise.
Sounds like a good idea, because Flying M Coffee House has been located on the corner of 5th and Idaho in downtown Boise since 1992, and they're currently celebrating their 30th anniversary.
I love it, because the coffee house is renowned in the local community for its quirky furnishings, eclectic crowd, high-quality coffee, and unique gift shack. They are proud to be voted the best of Boise in the Boise Weekly for over a decade now.
It's awesome. Mark, how do we find them online?
Go to flyingmcoffee.com.
We appreciate the support of Tammy Guzman and her business, Advanced Services LLC. Advanced Services has the staff and services to empower people with developmental disabilities, provide them with enriching experiences, and enable them to build a strong foundation for themselves and their families. They offer service coordination, medical transportation, a center and community-based adult developmental therapy, and adult day health and supported living services. You can reach Advanced Services at 208-461-0438 or at their website, advancedservicesidaho.com. Advanced Services has offices in Nampa and Emmett to suit your needs.
Hey, Jeff, you remember that house in the Collister neighborhood of Boise we were looking into because of that sadistic priest that lived there?
Man, that's a crazy story, and that house is even crazier.
I was thinking about our friends at Birch Leaf Group, brokered by eXp Realty, and I was thinking, those ladies sure can slang a house. They could even sell the crazy priest house. Whether you have a gimp in the basement or a skin shack in the backyard. Kara Harwick and Melissa Call of Birch Leaf, they can get your house sold and sold quick. Contact them at www.birchleafgroup.com or call them at 208-254-0490.
All right, and we're back from that lovely ad break, Mark. How'd you enjoy the ad break?
The outbreak?
The good one. I like, yeah. You got me on that
oh,
one.
Oh, yep. The ad break. I liked it. Yes. I liked it, Jeff.
We don't need another outbreak anytime soon.
Nope.
But Mark, we were just about to talk about the hero of our story. Why don't you introduce him?
Yes, sir. We have been getting to the introduction of Dr. Alan Hart, the person responsible for cutting death rates from TB in Idaho and elsewhere in half over the 1930s and 1940s and even more.
Dr. Hart really was an amazing person and medical professional, endlessly dedicated to eradicating this killer disease. Though Dr. Hart's father died in 1892 of typhoid when he was 2 years old, Hart felt that he might save people afflicted with the number one killer in the world, which was, like we said, Tuberculosis.
Yes, sir. You know, if he could help make it so others didn't lose their parents or other family members, he wanted to try.
So there's two things that make Dr. Alan Hart stand out as a particularly interesting topic for historians. And more historians, you know, they should research his amazing life. Was that he was one of the most brilliant minds in medicine during the early to mid 20th century, and also that he was born Lucille Hart in Hall Summit, Kansas on October 4th, 1890.
So from the start, as family correspondence and memories assert, Lucille was like most boys. He was like, you know, the majority of boys in Hall's Summit. And as she grew, she scorned women's work. The grandfather said, her mother said, she wanted nothing to do with inside chores that were categorized as women's work, and instead followed her grandfather around his ranch and farm conducting male tasks. The farm and ranch were in Albany, Oregon. This was the place Lucille and her mother moved after her father died of typhoid in 1892. But as she grew, she refused to wear dresses at most times and was known as a sort of tomboy in town. Lucille's grandfather loved her and accepted her as she was, making her toy rifles out of wood so she could act out famous Civil War battles. He was a veteran. He also gave her work so she could earn money to buy clothes that were typically for boys. You know, really wanted a straw boater hat, which was the fashion, you know, of the 1900s, early 1900s.
I also really want a straw boater hat.
I have one.
Oh, okay. Else.
I don't have one. I want one. We could wear them together.
True.
Wouldn't that be lame?
With our striped pink, like, yeah. Shirts and all that. Okay.
Hello, my baby. Hello, my darling.
Okay, this is getting weird. Keep going.
Okay. Yes, you're right. It is getting weird. But basically, a newspaper article from Hall Summit, Kansas, printed in 1921, as Dr. Hall was gaining fame, a summary of memories of those who knew him in Oregon and Kansas, and they basically read like this. Young Hart was different, even then. Boy's clothes just felt natural. Hart always regarded himself as a boy and begged his family to cut his hair and let him wear trousers. Hart disliked dolls but enjoyed playing doctor. He hated traditional girl tasks, preferring farm work with the men folk instead. The self-reliance that became a lifelong trait was evident early. Once, when he accidentally chopped off his fingertip with an axe, Hart dressed it himself, saying nothing about it to the family.
Damn.
That's pretty gnarly.
Yeah. Okay. So things became more challenging as Lucille became a teenager. Without a name to call himself, Lucille / Alan continued to hang around young men. This continued into his college years, where Lucille / Alan acknowledged disdain for a woman's mind at Albany Collegiate Institute, which is now Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon. The school transferring from Albany circa 1938. But Lucille / Alan debated with the women's club and they won regional championships. Lucille slash Alan, was the top student at every subject of study at the school. Hart next transferred to Stanford University with his now romantic partner, Eva Cushman, in 1911 to 1912, before returning to Albany, where he graduated as Lucille in 1913.
And so now Alan Moore, I'd say, than Lucille, went to the University of Oregon Medical Department in Portland, Oregon, where he graduated with his MD in 1917. And this is remarkable considering a person most deemed a woman, you know, by society, if not by he himself, they themselves, graduated as a doctor in 1917. Hart was upset that the degree stated Lucille as the recipient and felt it limited his chances of obtaining work.
That's probably right.
Yeah.
But he found work at the San Francisco Hospital as an intern in 1918. Just previous to this position, Hart had sought the help of one of his former professors at U of O. Go. What are those U of O?
Beavers.
Beavers.
Just kidding. Okay. Dickhead ducks.
Dickhead ducks.
Quack my ass, man. I don't like no ducks.
sorry. So Hart sought the help of one of his former professors at University of Oregon, psychiatrist Joshua Allen Gilbert. Hart confessed he had suicidal thoughts because living as a woman was torture. He sought the help to try to convert his mind to being that of a woman so his gender might match his anatomy.
Yeah, in the academic medical field of, which was a thing back then, sexology, this was a thing at the time, Hart's condition was diagnosed as a sexual inversion, where an individual of one sex acts with the comportment of another. Everything about them is generally male and or female, but they possess the genitalia or anatomy of the opposite. Many sexologists, but by no means the consensus of scientists or physicians, viewed this as a deviation from evolutionary norms, but one that was frequently natural to the sexual inverts, quote-unquote, themselves.
Many scientists at the time believed that more humans were once, quote, sexually inverted with traits of both, quote, sexes or, quote, genders, but that as humans developed, that different sexes began to separate more, making differentiation. Thank you. The norm. That's a hard one.
Yeah.
To be a, quote, sexual invert was to symbolize a digression to an earlier state of being, but one at no fault to the people experience the sexual inversion themselves. It was not seen as a moral shortcoming or a sin, even, by and large.
After attempting different therapies and failing to change Alan back to Lucille, how they saw it, a person Alan said he'd never been, Alan suggested he simply live life as a man. He convinced Gilbert to arrange a hysterectomy, the removal of the uterus, and an oophorectomy.
Okay.
Oophorectomy. That's where the ovaries are removed and the fallopian tubes. And he wanted this because he wanted to avoid experiencing what was to him the extremely traumatic experience of a woman's monthly cycle. Dr. Gilbert would later write in a report on the treatment of Dr. Hart that he was extremely intelligent and not mentally ill, but afflicted with a mysterious disorder for which I have no explanation. From a sociological and psychological standpoint, Hart is a man, and that living as one was Hart's only chance for a happy existence, the best that can be done. He continued saying, many Kodak pictures of H have been exhibited as those of a man without being questioned. Let him who finds in himself a tendency to criticize to offer some constructive method of dealing with the problem on hand. He will not want for difficulties. The patient and I have done our best with it. So He changed his name legally to Alan and began to live life as a man completely. Thus, Hart became the earliest example of a female-to-male transition in the United States in 1918, though this type of change had been surgically completed in Germany a decade prior.
But of course, right out of the gate, there were issues with this. A former classmate from Stanford recognized him there, and he was outed as a transgender in the Spokesman Review newspaper on February 6, 1918. Now, this was quickly reprinted in many Western and other newspapers. Another article stated, quote, Dr. Hart is a pretty co-ed from Stanford who had cut off her blonde curls and donned male attire, quote. Hart left the hospital, but issued a statement in an article called Dr. Hart Explains Change to Male Attire in the Albany Daily Democrat on March 26, 1918, page 1. He said that he was, quote, happier since I made this change than ever have in my life, and I will continue this way as long as I live. I have never concealed anything regarding my change to men's clothing. I came home to show my friends that I am ashamed of nothing.
Hart had moved to Gardiner, Oregon, to set up his practice with Inez Stark, whom he had married in February of 1918, and she was an old school co-student. But however, before he could get situated as a physician in Gardiner, he was outed again by another classmate and left his new life and practice behind yet again. However, though it might not have seemed so at the time, Hart not settling down into a routine practice benefited others, as Hart would go on to save many thousand lives.
So by 1920, the company Bayer, which most people know as the aspirin company these days, they were manufacturing synthetic hormones, and Dr. Hart began taking them to lower his voice and grow facial hair. But synthetic hormones would not be widely available in the U.S. until the 1940s. Living as Alan, Dr. Hart went to Montana and then New Mexico, where he first worked in a sanatorium where he experienced TB patients for the first time. Alan divorced Inez in 1925 and married Edna Ruddick soon after. They moved to the Trudeau School of Tuberculosis in New York, where he conducted more postgraduate work, eventually making his way to the University of Pennsylvania, where he earned a master's degree in radiology. This is about where Idaho comes in, but first, he moved to Tacoma, and he became director of radiology at Tacoma General Hospital in 1929.
When Hart began working in radiology and seeing how it was, you know, successfully being used to locate tumors and bone fractures, he knew it would be a reliable tool to detect TB throughout the body as well.
Yeah, so Hart was among the first physicians to understand that tuberculosis started in the lungs, as many knew, but spread via the circulatory system to the spine, the brain, the bones, and organs and glands. If TB could be detected before spreading throughout the lungs and into the rest of the body, they could save many lives by isolating that spread and treating the patients early on.
And now we arrive at Idaho, which was desperate to eradicate TB in the early 1930s. A cure had still not been found, so managing TB through treatment was the strategy. Dr. Hart had worked in Idaho since 1926, off and on, when he was hired to do X-ray work for the Sacred Heart Hospital in Spokane. Dr. Hart worked in Idaho since 1926, and he was hired to do X-ray work for the Sacred Heart Hospital in Spokane, Washington. But it was now, at this time, that Hart would also screen for TB in other parts of Idaho in association with the Idaho Anti-Tuberculosis Association. At this time, he also traveled to Pennsylvania and got his master's and then headed back west again. The dude traveled.
Dude, yeah, like, yeah. I'm so amazed that people that could just, like, get a master's degree like that.
Yeah, like, look at all the guys going on. He gets a transition surgery,
yeah.
Starts taking hormones,
yeah.
Getting a master's degree, working in Tacoma, changing a job to Spokane, traveling back to Pennsylvania, and that seems like a lot.
That is a lot.
Yeah.
But back in Idaho during the 1930s, officials were eager to make sure that TB was contained and didn't become any worse. Rates had declined in the 1920s with more knowledge about hygiene and density. This, of course, was true in Idaho, but spikes alarmed people a great deal as TB was still extremely deadly, and many people remembered the time before death rates dropped. So in 1933, Dr. Hart was hired as a consultant by the Idaho Anti-Tuberculosis Association, the IATA, is that a word?
IATA.
Yeah, IATA.
IATA.
he was hired by the IATA as a consultant. This allowed him to travel extensively throughout Idaho, conducting chest screenings, as he called them, to lessen the stigmatization, giving educational presentations and offering educational materials for organizations and the public.
Yeah, so I didn't really mention this that much, but after they find that it's contagious, you know, through, you know, sneezing and you know, from infectious disease, it wasn't so much like, oh, look at the pretty deathly ill poet. You know, it was more like, oh man, this person's infected and we need to get them away. So there was a stigmatization from it. Okay. So he tried to help them with that as much as he could.
Yeah. But, well, not only that, like he called them, what did he say, chest screenings instead of tuberculosis?
Yeah.
Tests?
Yeah. So, yeah. So yeah. They tried to definitely change the vocabulary.
Yeah.
He also streamlined processes and reframed how the public viewed TB patients. He himself called himself a chest specialist or chest doctor to come across as more approachable as well. He created a program of TB testing vans that traveled the state and educated people in small towns as well as larger cities. They would do scratch tests where, you know, more like an injecting of a little bit of what they called tuberculin, which was a sterile protein extract from the cultures of tubercular bacillus, or the tuberculosis bug, as I'll just call it. They inject a little of that into your, just under your skin, and if it turned red later, you were infected with latent TB.
Which I've had that done going to work for corrections.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I had in the Peace Corps that made me know that I had latent tuberculosis.
Yeah.
Thank goodness for government medicine. That's not something I wanted to have spread to my spine, that's for sure.
Yes.
But basically, if you needed it, the tech on Hart's vans would, you know, x-ray your chest if you had a positive scratch test. And so you come, you go in the van, and it'd be parked somewhere, you know, probably City Hall or something like that. And you get on that van, and they could do everything you needed right there, blood tests and chest screenings, x-rays.
Just stay out of the van that's parked back in the alley. You don't want to go in that van.
Yeah, yeah. It would be clearly labeled. lots of red and white on it. Mm-hmm. A weird cross-looking thing for TB, you know, like a double cross.
Bowl of candy, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wait, no, that's the other van.
Never yeah, mind. Wrong yeah. van, Jeff. but if they were, you know, if they were found to have, you know, lesions identifiable on their chest x-ray or anywhere else, they would be isolated and recommended to go to a TB sanatorium.
Dr. Hart was pretty dang good at his job because in 1937, the Idaho State Department of Public Health hired him as the state TB specialist. It's a pretty fancy title.
That is a fancy.
He also became Idaho's tuberculosis control officer. Seems like a good paycheck there.
Yeah.
So he screened, treated, and taught for most of the 1940s, taking a six-month leave of absence to help the Army screen for TB in 1943 during World War II. When the war ended, Hart started on a new project, the creation of Gooding TB Hospital, built on the grounds where there was once a Methodist college with two matching buildings. One was constructed in 1917 and the other in 1920.
Yeah, and it's the 1921 that I've been told and read is the one where everybody goes now. It's the one surviving building of the whole complex, and it's supposed to be super haunted.
You mean the one you can pay like $300 to go?
Yeah, I was like, I'll pay like $100 something, but man, that's a lot.
Yeah.
You know? Jeez. But yeah, so when the college closed in 1938, the state of Idaho purchased the land in 1941 with the intention of converting it then into a TB hospital, but the construction materials were all going to the war effort, so a third building and portable wood barracks weren't constructed until 46-47, after the war. And this was not a sanatorium that they built, but a working hospital specialized in TB detection and treatment. So streptomycin was discovered by Rutgers graduate student and soon-to-be doctor Albert Schatz on October 19th, 1943 at 2 a.m. This dude has an amazing story. Like, he found this in like 3 months. He isolated himself in a weird basement laboratory. That's where all the good work comes from. Yeah. And he was totally at risk of catching this himself. But he found this, you know, the say billions and millions of lives by finding this basically this cure. But it takes time to test and refine to be used on humans, because they had to like do something with it to make it be able to be tested on guinea pigs, and they had to do trials. So though he'd found it in 43, it wasn't for another couple of years that it gets widely, you know, spread out. So in the meantime,
sounds like the guy who discovered LSD rode his bicycle home. Oh, hi, shit.
If you're taking LSD for TB, man, you got a problem.
Hey, you know, whatever eases the pain.
You try to pet the basilisk.
But so while they were, you know, testing and manufacturing and making it widely available, you know, basically it was the same process, you know, screen, diagnose, and treat as it had been for the last two decades or more, obviously going back all the way to ancient Egypt or so, right?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Gooding Hospital was set up as a well-oiled machine, and by the time Hart took a new job in Connecticut as head of the Mass X-ray Program for the State Health Department.
Yeah, he worked with Craig Knudsen in Connecticut.
Oh, the Morrison Knudsen guy?
No, I'm just, my buddies and I used to do this game to see how many Connecticuts we could
ever done. Okay.
Okay. Call Craig Knudsen in Connecticut.
Sorry, we're talking about Morrison Knudsen in the next episode, so that's where my mind went.
Oh, we are? Yeah, I'm just being a dork. Sorry. yeah, but I get myself off track, Jeff, with my stupid jokes.
Get myself off, too.
We actually found an old booklet given to patients that was given to them at Gooding when they entered the hospital explaining what their stay would include in Gooding, as well as a book filled with photos of the Gooding TB hospital, in which a patient's arrival and processing at the facility is portrayed step by step.
Upon arrival, a patient would first be checked in by the front secretary, followed by a nurse taking the patient to their room and explaining the rules to them. They would next be interviewed by the medical doctor and a superintendent of nurses. Blood and urinalysis would be taken and be examined, as well as a sample of sputum, you know, the mucus. The patients would then get a chest x-ray taken, and over a few days, the doctors would diagnose the severity of the patient's TB. Based on this diagnosis, a patient's treatment plan would be created.
The treatment plan consisted of all rest for the most severe cases wherein, you know, riding could even be deemed too taxing. Healthy diets full of, you know, good robust fats were generated by the on-site dietitian. The rooms and facilities were kept in a pristine state of cleanliness by the extremely conscientious janitorial and maid services, and if the doctors felt that a patient was up to it, they could walk around the grounds of the hospital and go to the cafeteria.
Fluoroscopy, or the scanning of the body with x-ray consistently and not as a photo, could also be conducted. They looked for air or gas in the abdominal cavity, or air and gas around the lung could be looked for. These things often resulted from trauma, like the type you get when someone intentionally collapses on the lung.
Yeah, that'll do it, right? Okay. You know? Ooh. So these unfortunate patients could often be bronchoscoped, and I'm not talking like, or bronchioscoped. I'm not talking like the old Bronco, BSU Broncos. Good
Broncos.
You know, that kind of stuff. But it was done to, you know, basically you shoved camera-esque thing, I think, I don't know, down the person's throat and into the lung area so you could see the amount of TB activity in there. And so basically, when you were at this TB hospital, you were told what to do and poked and prodded all the time. And then you were exposed to surgeries of an extreme nature as well. But it could save lives.
And so Dr. Hart took that job in Connecticut, and he left the Jim State, but he left behind a legacy in lives saved, which was thousands over the 10 years he assisted in Idaho before streptomycin was discovered. The good doctor dropped the death rate from TB to 1/50th of what had been prior to his arrival here in Idaho.
Yeah, and Dr. Alan Hart continued to live and work in Connecticut, dying in Hartford at the age of 71 in 1962. He was still married to Edna Hart, but she returned to the Puget Sound area and spread his ashes on the Sound, where they had shared wonderful times together, as she attested. And so, what do we make of the legacy of Dr. Hart? Some have claimed he was a lesbian, including the lesbian community in and around Portland. They, in turn, had disagreements with the trans community in the area and throughout the country, actually, that claimed Dr. Hart as a trans hero. Some asserted she was a she, but only pretended to be a man to make life better for herself and her career. This is BS, because who's going to have major operations, you know, without being sincere?
Good point.
You know, you're going to take out the history, you know, the uterus and the ovaries and fallopian tubes if you're not serious. Some asserted she was...
Well, can I interject there, Mark, really quick, that Dr. Hart went through the whole process of counseling, worked with a psychiatrist, and, you know, was very sure that that's who they were and what they wanted to be.
Yeah, he wanted to actually be converted back to being the quote-unquote proper way, right? Mm-hmm. And that's something that Hart desperately wanted, just so they could, you know, he could be normal, she could be normal. But he's like, I'm a he, I cannot go back and be somebody I'm not, that I never was. And so, you know, what we do know is that Dr. Hart saved thousands of lives here in Idaho and elsewhere. We also know the doctor was a trailblazer who took a stand for patients' rights and their comfort. From Native Americans to poor white Americans to the rich, he treated all comers. Dr. Hart did not see himself as trans, but instead as a man born with the wrong genitalia. He was a sexually inverted person in the that time period's terms. You know, and he was a scientist, researcher, doctor, physician, whatever. And so he would go with what most doctors in sexology thought that he was too, and that's how he saw himself, as a natural diversion out of from the norm. It was natural to him, though it wasn't typical of what happened when people are born.
Right.
And so before we maybe have a little free discussion, I want to leave people with this quote from an expert sociologist, Rowan Connell, from the University of Sydney, Australia. And she's a specialist in the study of masculinity. And she basically says that while the practice of undergoing female-to-male transition is not new, neither is it static. As sexologists of Hart's time documented, people have transitioned to living as a sex other than the one assigned to them at birth since ancient times and across the globe. What differs depending on era, location, and culture is how people have changed gender categories, not the fact that they have done so throughout history. Transsexual is a modern word for a technologically enhanced version of an old practice. Indeed, affecting a transition from living as one sex to living as another is not limited to our modern concept of medically dependent excursion. Through most of history, such endeavors have included a broad range of social cultural assertions. So, Jeff Meacham, what's your two cents?
So, here in America, there's been a huge pushback against transgenders lately. But my two cents on this, again, my opinion, is that America is a place where people are supposed to live the lives that makes them happy. That's what Dr. Alan Hart was doing. Now, Let's take away the transgender aspect of his story and talk about how many lives he saved. Tens of thousands, maybe even more. Who knows? Like, you can't put it, can't quantify an exact number on that. But he did save a lot of lives, made lives better, saved a lot of grief and heartache and pain for people. Not only the people who were directly afflicted with it, but their friends and family. So I think a lot of people can't separate, probably if they heard the story, if they sat and listened to the story, they probably couldn't separate the transgender person from the doctor, right?
Right.
So I'm asking, you know, you people to do that. Like, think about this person as a person who saved lives, who did everything he could do to make people's lives happier and better.
And, oh, sorry.
No, that's fine. Like, I was just going to wrap up and say, like, Dr. Hart's a hero for doing that. Not only, you know, in this time period where it was, you know, we don't, like, you know, we don't think about tuberculosis as a pandemic, but it was like what we went through with COVID-19 times, you know, a million. So even just being a healthcare professional in that environment automatically makes him a hero.
Yeah.
Add the extra stress and everything else that goes along with the transgender on top of all that. I can't put into words like how proud I am of, you know, having this person work in our state and help Idahoans, everyday Idahoans, you know. That's what I have to say, Mark.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, the crazy thing is that as a woman, Dr. Hart would not have been as effective.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a fact. People wouldn't have gone to them or believed in him.
That's wild. Like, yeah.
Yeah. And so I was careful to use, you know, her in the beginning to show that while deemed a her, all these other things were going on. In fact, on her grandparents' obituaries, one that the grandfather had written for the grandmother when she passed, they had said, you know, they're survived by their grandson, which is a hell of a thing to say for some old school ranchers.
There was also a quote you had in here where it referred to Dr. Hart as a he from that time period.
Yes. So that's the thing. There, even back then, you think, oh, nobody's going to accept this. But actually, from what I've seen, there was more acceptance of it. So, yes, it was looked at as a lesser state of evolution, being that people, many sexologists and scientists believed, at one point had been more bisexual or had gender traits from one or the other, right? But they also noted a distinction between gender traits and what sex or anatomy of sex you're born with, and that there was much more going on in what composes a person's sex and then gender layered on top of that than just what type of genitalia you had. And so it was very confusing to them then, but they did say that people that are quote unquote sexually inverted, or that's their term back then, were naturally that way. They even tried. They had suicidal thoughts. They had problems. They tried to change back to what society wanted them to be so that they could not be an outcast, but it was just not natural for them. They just couldn't do it. And so then they, you know, sought desperate treatments, and that's what Hart did. Hart chose to live over killing himself.
And that's not something that's changed today. A lot of transgender people are, in fact, at the highest risk for the suicidal ideations.
Yeah. And so, you know, I want to say that, you know, we are part of some great, or, you know, organizations that are, or I don't know. I don't know what you call these people. Hell Meridian, Boise Bubble,
your Pearl House friends.
Pearl House Collective, you know, we can go on. Part of these groups that I think are just, we realize there's a lot of complex science going on here. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah.
But Dr. Hart, to get back to what you were saying, whether he, you see them as a he, or you see them as a she. I'm going to call Dr. Alan Hart what Dr. Alan Hart called Dr. Alan Hart, which was a he.
Right.
Because he earned that by saving thousands and thousands and thousands of lives, irregardless of what those people would have thought about him. You know, and yeah, there are many people that are still alive in Idaho because he led to saving their father or grandfather, great grandfather.
It would be interesting to look at descendants of those people, you know,
yeah,
and see what their feelings are on the whole transgender issue today and see if that's influenced them at all.
Yeah, and so I'm sure we're going to get some angry thoughts, but I bet there are some people who are like, you know, yeah, you know, I agree with what you're saying to some degree, and, you know, whether I agree with Hart or not and his, you know, definition of self, he did save a lot of lives and therefore is a hero regardless of, you know, that aspect of his life.
I definitely welcome the angry emails on this one, angry Facebook comments, because like you said, I'm sure we'll get them. But I just want to, you know, for a second, speak to anyone who is undergoing or, you know, thinking about suicide, transgender or not. Please reach out to someone, email us. You know, Mark, you and I have both dealt with stuff like that in our personal lives, so we get it. Yeah, so I don't know, Mark, like it's interesting to see the backlash, but again though, to anyone who is undergoing, you know, transition, whatever, if you have thoughts that you're not right, talk to people, talk to someone that cares about you, and work through it, because like Dr. Alan Hart proved, you can get through it, you can go on to do great things.
There are people out there who see you as great, good, natural. And if people out there don't accept you, there are people that do. So just know that. And we're two of those people right here.
Yes. All right, Mark, you got anything else?
Nope, that was a good one.
All right, so why don't we come back next week and we'll do a little Vietnam War protesting. How about that?
Oh, so a lighthearted episode, Jeff.
Yes, sir.
All right. Ready right on.
All right, we'll see y'all next week.
Later.
If you want to get a hold of us, send an email to info@idahistory.com. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Ida History. You can visit us on the web at idahistory.com. Ida History would like to thank our listeners, sponsors, and contributors. If you want to know how you can become a contributor, go to idahistory.com/podcast. Please consider giving us a rating and review on your podcast app. I'm Tom Hart, and this is Devil's Count.